This is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. on www.prn.fm. This radio presentation replays my weekly TV show, Refounding America with Peter R. Breggin, MD, which can be watched on Brighteon.tv, and it's available on Roku. I interview guests who are heroes and pioneers in confronting the global predators who are behind COVID-19 lockdowns and vaccines, corrupt public health and medicine, global warming, the Great Reset, and other justifications for destroying the Western democracies. They are stealing our countries, our freedoms, our dignity and hope, and our jobs and our savings. For documentation of this worldwide tragedy, read our new book, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey, by Peter and Ginger Breggin. Together, my guests and I explore what is happening and what we each can do to refound America and inspire the world. Thank you for your courage in facing these challenges and standing up for liberty. Here are four principles for living like an American. Protect freedom. Take responsibility at all times. Express gratitude for every gift and opportunity. Become a source of love. Once again, these are the times that try our souls. We must find the strength and the courage to rise up to refound America in the spirit of liberty. Well, welcome, my wonderful, wonderful, wonderful audience. I want to start out right away and say the guest today is Harvey Riesch, MD, PhD. It's worth saying at the start. This is Peter Breggin. You're listening to Refounding America and Reclaiming Ourselves. They go together. We must rebuild America, and we must reclaim our love of freedom. You can watch this on Brighteon TV, which is what we're on. You can also listen to it on the radio on PRN.live. I'm going to say a few words about courage when we begin the show, because I believe that Dr. Riesch exemplifies what I believe is the most difficult and rare kind of courage there is. That is the courage to stand up where your identity is at stake, where everything you've built, you might have to rebuild. Fortunately, hasn't happened to him. Well, we're on today with Dr. Harvey Riesch. He's professor of epidemiology at that great Ivy League school, Yale. He's got an MD and a PhD. His PhD is in biomathematics. Now, I mean, if somebody's got a PhD in biomathematics, he's a serious brain. I don't know. My wife, who's got an amazing brain, considers herself a nerd. I don't know if you consider yourself a nerd or grew up thinking of yourself as a nerd, but I think of people who have that kind of intelligence as a little bit intimidating to me. It's sort of like the Harvard-Yale thing, an MIT thing. I mean, you get that kind of PhD and you really know that you know how to think. And Harvey is one of the most heroic people in the United States of America and in the world today. Because once you've gotten the MD and you've gotten the PhD and you have so much online, you have built so much, you have worked so hard for so much. And I believe that to stand up and take on a cause for the sake of, and we'll be interesting to hear what he has to say about it, of humanity, or to take on something because for the sake of truth or of science, against your own establishment is the most difficult thing in the world to do. I didn't have to do it this time because I did it back in the 1990s, and you know, I got put on the outside and didn't have that to lose anymore after I took on the drug companies as a medical expert back in those days. But I think it takes more courage to do what Harvey's done than, let's say, that when he goes outside, he sees a burning car and he runs up and he saves some children out of the car. People do that all the time. All kinds of folks do what's expected of them that's reinforced by society. So policemen are brave, yes, and firemen are brave, and the Good Samaritan is brave, but they're going to get a medal. And it's reinforced and it's instinctual. There's something in us that wants to save somebody in front of us. To instead spontaneously take on an issue, like Dr. Risch has done, that my friend Peter McCullough has done, Zev Zelenko has done, as Lev Leed has done, these marvelous physicians that you know I work with along with many others. I believe, Harvey, that your kind of courage is the rarest and the most important in maintaining a sane civil society. I don't know if you've ever thought of it that way.
Well, thanks for your support. Actually, I think that people who have this kind of courage deny that they have it, me included, that we do things in a very natural way that seems to us just doing the right thing. And maybe it's my naivete, you know, being a technically adept kind of person, that I don't think about all the ramifications, all the social ramifications and stuff like that, because I understand the science. I've been a scientist for my whole career, maybe even longer, maybe even as a kid, I was already a proto-scientist. And I think that you comment about the world the way you see it. You observe it as empirically and objectively as you can. And I'm not going to lie and say nature doesn't say something that it does, you know. That to me, what's the point of being a scientist if you're reporting something other than the clear observations that you make about nature? So I can't say anything different if the world works a way it does. Now, if I got evidence that that contradicted the evidence that I had reviewed at some point, I would have to reevaluate my position and update the science and draw a new conclusion. But of course, that actually never happened over the 2 years of what I was studying. And so I'm just not going to lie and say the world works differently when my clear observations and others are very on point and clear.
Well, I think that's a very, very interesting quality that you have, a real strength of character that you just went ahead and pursued. I know for me, even now, there's always a certain amount of fear and anxiety surrounding so many of the things we're doing now. And I think it's really interesting what you're saying. We were talking earlier, and you spoke about, right, really in basically in the same tone, of the science now being, you know, relatively firm. I don't like the word established too much, because one of the things that keyed me off that everything was gone awry was when Fauci said that they established, the science was established, and he was the one who represented it. But you were saying we know the science, and I agree with you about that. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So we've had 2 years of being told what the science was. In fact, I argue that this isn't science, this was plausibility. We've been told what the plausibility was. In order to understand science, you have to go back to the evidential studies that bear on your theories about how the world works, how things work. So being told that masks work is not science. Going and reading the original studies that have done to see whether or not masks work, in which ways, whether reducing spread to other people or protecting the mask wearer, those studies, you have to read them. You have to decide whether they're done invalidly and whether the conclusions are appropriate and so on. That's the evidence and that's the science. And so we've been told what the science was without actually being told the science itself. And that's not science, that's plausibility. So when you think that if you put a mask over your face, it's going to block what goes in and what goes out, that's plausibility. But the science is going and testing it in conditions that it would be normally used by the people who would normally use it at the risks they normally face with the particles that are the ones in question, and then doing all the relevant measurements. That's how you do science. And that hasn't been done. And to the degree that it has been done, it shows that the masks don't do very much. So we've learned over the last 2 years, and in fact, even before, because there's many mask studies about influenza and other viruses and particles, that for the size of this virus and the fact that it's not generally waterborne and droplets, that the masks don't do very much. They don't reduce the spread and they don't much protect the wearer in the masks that are normally worn. And so the plausibility of saying you wear a mask, it does something because it's in front of your nose and your mouth, is overridden by the actual empirical data that you have to study and draw conclusions from. And not only that, the problem with this is that you can't believe me. You can't believe Dr. Fauci. You can't believe anyone until you've gone to the same studies and read them for yourself. So if you choose to believe me, then you might be getting some kind of scientific opinion, and you can get any scientific opinion you want just by cherry picking who you go to believe. And so that's a problem with the fact that most people aren't scientists and they have to draw their conclusions from, in general, other people rather than the original studies. But for me as a scientist, I go back and I look at the original studies and draw my conclusions from those. I think we've learned a huge amount about the virus and its management over the last 2 years. So we know that masks may do a little in very short interactions with people in indoor spaces, but in longer times in indoor spaces and certainly outdoors, they don't do much, either to protect the wearer or to protect the people around for what's called source control. We've learned that social distancing is basically silly. Social distancing arose because two CDC people walking out of an elevator were trying to decide whether they should say 3 feet or 10 feet, and they settled on six, and that's what they put out as their opinion, so it's said. That's not science. That's not empirical observation. That's not measuring anything. That's just plausibility. And lockdowns are the same way. It's a plausibility that if you lock people down, that you can't spread the virus. Well, you spread the virus within the house or whatever, but the idea that lockdowns do anything is they have to open up eventually, and then the people who didn't gain herd immunity from being locked down are now sponges waiting to receive the virus that's in circulation at the time of opening the lockdowns. So they defer, but they don't really solve the problem of viral spread in a population. And the same with early treatment. Early treatment was what I got involved in studying at the beginning of the pandemic. I'm a member of the Connecticut Academy of Science and Engineering, and the Academy struck a advisory committee to help the governor with figuring out how to reopen Connecticut when we were planning to reopen. We weren't the official committee. We were an unofficial committee that was comprised of kind of out-of-the-box people, myself, the dean of the School of Public Health, there was a clinical psychologist, some physicists, a jet engine airplane designer who knows about airflow and things like that. And so we were all tasked with figuring out things. And my job was to look at early outpatient treatment. And that's how I got into hydroxychloroquine, remdesivir, and so on, early treatments for COVID in March, April of 2020. And so when I started reading the literature of these studies, there was a very clear association between early use of hydroxychloroquine in the first few days of infection, not beyond 5 or 6 days, generally, along with vitamin D and zinc and maybe other vitamins and other things, but in general with those things, and very significantly reduced risk of hospitalization and mortality. So this was outpatients. And so I compiled all this. I did a very thorough review, a very thorough analysis, an analysis of why epidemiologists accept this kind of evidence and lab people don't, and why lab people think they understand epidemiology, which they don't, and so on. And I wrote this up in a long essay in the American Journal of Epidemiology. And what I started hearing in the media was the very strange response, which is, hydroxychloroquine has been studied in hospital patients and it doesn't work there, therefore it can't possibly work in outpatients. And I could not understand that extrapolation. It makes no sense scientifically, because outpatient COVID is a flu-like illness. It starts with a cough or sneezing, headaches, muscle aches, tiredness, and so on, very flu-like. And in some people, after 7 or 8 days, it becomes a pneumonia, a very potentially very severe pneumonia, where the virus is more or less long gone, but the immune system is still overreacting and depositing large amounts of immune system debris in the lungs, clogging up the lungs. And that's a totally different disease, requires different treatment than outpatient disease, and therefore different drugs. And so to extrapolate from inpatient hospital disease to outpatient disease, every doctor who treats COVID must know that difference or they shouldn't be treating COVID. And so for the media, the reporters to say this, I just chalked it up to poor reporting, sloppy reporting. I've always experienced sloppy reporting in all of my studies, in my cancer research studies in the past, so it didn't strike me as unusual, but it grew. And I couldn't understand at the outset why this was happening, why people were extrapolating, and then the FDA was extrapolating as well inappropriately and claiming on the FDA's website, which is still there to this day, hazard in using hydroxychloroquine and stating in black box letter warnings not to use hydroxychloroquine in outpatients for treatment of COVID, and then in fine print underneath saying we base this on adverse events seen in hospitalized patients. And as I've said, there are two different diseases, two different treatments, two different circumstances. Hospitalized patients have a much more severe disease, also produces adverse events from the disease, let alone the treatments. And so evidence and use in hospitalized patients does not bear on outpatient disease. Yet the FDA was saying this. It's a fraudulent statement on their website. And it's been up there for almost two years. That makes no sense, except that there's some other motivation for why they have it there. So this is kind of where I was left, that I understood the science. I don't go and just stand up and say I have an opinion on something and therefore must be right. You know, I'm a scientist, and so I studied the science, and when I have an opinion about the science, because that's what I studied, that's what I'm willing to stand up for. If I'm wrong, if there's new evidence that comes up that disproves the earlier evidence, then I say, well, now I got to put all the evidence together, come up with a new opinion about how nature works, and go and espouse that until that evolves. But so far, all the studies of hydroxychloroquine that came out after I wrote the major paper have supported 100% what I observed in the first place. Now there's 9 or 10 studies with 40,000 patients who've been studied in these studies. They all show 75% reduced mortality in the people who got hydroxychloroquine. It's not possible for that to have occurred because of any potential biases or confounding, because it's way too large for the magnitude of an association to have to occur by chance. And so we know that there's benefit. There's also 50% reduction in hospitalization comes out of these studies, and very similar findings, to be frank, with ivermectin that has been studied later, not quite as many studies, but the studies show exactly the same thing. So that's how I got into this, that basically the science does show what it shows about how nature works. And you read it and you do the best job you can for understanding it. And how could anybody say anything else than what the science shows?
Do you want to talk some about what you found out with vaccines as well? And that will get us to a nice coverage initially here. We have 7 minutes for this segment.
Sure. So I'm not an expert in the vaccines, I have to say at the outset, that I've studied vaccine and vaccine epidemiology. And to me, the interesting thing about the vaccines is the knowledge of how they perform has evolved. That when the vaccines first came out, there was very good reason to think they were going to provide benefit, that the mechanisms of action are potentially good, that they had a role to play in reducing and creating more immunity to the virus and so on. But what we've learned over time is that the vaccine benefit is relatively short-lived, that it wanes over time, that what's most definitive about this are the British data from Public Health UK that show that the over approximately 4 to 5 months, the efficacy in reducing infection goes to zero and turns negative. They predispose to getting infected after that period of time. The efficacy in reducing severe disease, hospitalization, mortality may last longer, so there's still some potential benefit. But we've also seen a very large amount of adverse events and mortality with these vaccines that has to be reckoned in the decisions to use them. And So I've all along, I've never said that the vaccine should not be used. I think it's a trade-off, like everything else in medicine, that you have to do the best job you can in evaluating your personal, your patient's risks and the potential benefit to be gained. But what we've seen in the Public Health UK data is that in adults over age 18, the risk of becoming symptomatically infected with Omicron is approximately threefold. For fully vaccinated, in other words, boosted adults, is approximately threefold the risk in unvaccinated people. Now, of course, you could say unvaccinated people have different spectrum of behaviors and so on than vaccinated people, and so maybe they would be afraid of going out and mixing in crowds and doing other things that would predispose them to getting infected. But a threefold or a fourfold difference in rate is not accounted for by behavioral differences. In general, we see behavioral differences on the order of 1.5-fold, maybe twofold, and so on. So a 3 to 4-fold difference in magnitude of risk of getting infected, higher for fully vaccinated people than unvaccinated people, is something that is there. What we can argue about how big that magnitude actually is, but the fact is that it is there and shows that the vaccines do not protect from getting symptomatically infected after some number of months, 3 months, 4 months, maybe 2 months after the third booster, maybe even less after a fourth booster. So it's clear that the vaccines have had diminishing returns over time as the virus has evolved and as people's immune system has gotten basically trained on the vaccines for the great majority of people who've been vaccinated. And I think that's how we have to view this, that the vaccines are a product useful in the management of risk for the people for whom there would be benefit that outweighs their risks. And that's a personal clinical decision with one's physician or healthcare provider rather than across the board statement. And in fact, given that the vaccines do not reduce spread, there is no state interest, no government interest in vaccinating everybody because as of now, it would be counterproductive. It would increase the number of infections rather than decrease them, according to Public Health UK.
Yeah, that's a really good analysis, obviously. I would put a little different emphasis on two aspects of the vaccines. One is whether there was any hope for them at the start and whether there was a good rationale to it. They'd never been tried before, and Moderna had never even had a product before these
Well,
vaccines.
Moderna never had a human product. It did, I believe it did have animal vaccines. And
I'm not sure of that. I mean, Moderna was, I mean, it had done work in the area, but Moderna was new and, just created in around 2008 or 9, as I remember. But anyway, I'll check it out. We can both check that out. But at any rate, the other part of that is that I did a real research on the animal stuff and the animal research because people thought there hadn't been any animal research. And I outline it a lot in the book, in COVID-19, The Global Predators, We Are the Prey. And the animal studies showed definitively that you couldn't make good vaccines because they mutate too rapidly, the particular virus, among other reasons, and also that they were quite deadly. And in the book, I have a study I found, which was like the final one that came out in 2020 from a reputable journal funded by Fauci, funded by his NIAID, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And that study once again showed that mice were getting tremendous, and the review showed that animals were getting tremendous inflammatory reactions to the vaccines, similar to the ones we're seeing now in human beings, that animals were dying from it. Other studies showed that if you gave an animal a SARS-CoV, and these were studies from 2015 and earlier, that if you gave SARS-CoV to an animal and then you vaccinated it, you had a high rate of death, that the rates of death were even higher among the animals that had a vulnerability. They were either older or they had immune problems, which they're able to do genetically now. And corresponding with that, I don't think there's any choice for a physician. I think physicians should stop the use of the vaccines and protest against it. I mean, the average number of total deaths we ever had from all vaccines in any year before this vaccine was around 180, 120. Most vaccines, no deaths at all. And that if a vaccine had several deaths, in some cases even suspicion there could be a death, that maybe a bug got into the vaccine, they'd taken off the market. And you never had a vaccine that was left on the market with two dozen deaths. We got about 40 or 50 deaths, I think, about the H1N1 virus. I think that was the one vaccine. But those occurred after it had already been withdrawn for about 20 neurological problems. Now, these are reports. We're talking about how many reports there to be withdrawn. So if you were to withdraw a vaccine on 30 reports, 20 reports, you wouldn't even let it get that far in the past. Now we have 30,000 reports to the CDC, and we have a good, sound physiologic basis for the deaths we're seeing. They occur very close to the vaccine, at least half of them within a few days. They represent sometimes the clotting problems that we know exist, and so on. So, I bet I've run over time here. So I just want to say I disagree on some of that. When we come back, let's address some of that if we can. Well, we're having a wonderful conversation with Dr. Harvey Risch, and PhD, he's an MD, doctor, and professor of epidemiology at Yale. He asked me to summarize the questions I'd raised for him where I was having, you know, a different emphasis than him. And one of my emphases was that we did know ahead of time that from the animal research that this should not be given to human beings. That was the conclusion of the 2020 paper that I was citing that came out right during Operation Warp Speed. They said, don't try it on animals. And it was funded by no less than Fauci himself. So it wasn't like obscure, he wouldn't know about it. So I was saying long beforehand that we should not be using these viruses, these vaccines, and not really vaccines, they're much too dangerous. They involve technologies that are not very tried and true at all. Put on top of that, the conditions under which they were going to be studied, which was a rush through under heavy political pressure and huge federal funding. And I was not in favor of them at all to start with. But then I also wanted to raise the question of why you would suggest that we should leave open whether or not, reasonable clinicians should be using the vaccines when they were deadly in ways that we've never come close to previously. My friend and your friend, Peter McCullough, has said that they're going to end up killing more people than the diseases itself, which I think may have already even happened. Because when you get reports of 30,000 deaths, you have to multiply that as a minimum by 10 for what actually is happening.
I'll stop there.
You're not sure about what?
About what the multiplier is for mortality.
Oh, I can tell you what the research, as far as I know. I've actually testified in court a lot about the multipliers because I did many cases involving FDA and approval of drugs and stuff like that. And the studies are not great, but the minimum is that if you get one report, at least 10 others that haven't been reported. The maximum runs around 100, and it's so wide it shows you how unpredictable it is. But I think commonly it's much higher than 10, and that in the case of these vaccines, there's so much pressure on the doctors not to even think the vaccines have side effects. They never tell their patients, almost never. They don't want to report anything. They don't want to get in trouble. So if the max we've seen usually is one report equals 100 events, I think you got a lot of reason to believe this is even worse than that. And then we have, of course, let me just finish one thing. You have the ancillary study. The other studies like the increase in deaths among healthy people that the insurance companies are coming up with no other possible explanation for this large change. Then you've had studies over also at Medicare, Medicaid, about the numbers of deaths being reported that are inexplicably high. I'll give it back to you now, Harvey.
So I've actually also done a lot of consulting work for pharma and dealt with the FAERS, which is the FDA's Drug Adverse Events Reporting System database, and
Thank
looked at reporting factors. And I think the issue is that each disease, each outcome that could be caused by a drug or a vaccine has different tendencies to report. And so things that are more serious are more likely to get reported. Things that are less serious are less likely to get reported. I think you're right that between 10 and 100 fold is a reasonable guess at the things that are moderately serious but not terribly serious. I think the things that are very indicative and rare and basically only show up for a very peculiar, unique adverse event and a drug will get reported very highly. And I think deaths get reported very highly, at least within a few days of the vaccination. So, we could argue about this all the time.
But Harry, just one point. Don't you think doctors are scared to get involved in anything like that now?
Yes, now they are. I think earlier in the pandemic they were less. And the other thing you have to realize is doctors are not the only ones who are able to report. Family members can
No,
report.
but about the majority in this case, we know are professional people reporting, and families don't make these connections. They got the darn. I think reporting is going to be much worse now. Most people, they're getting the vaccines at pharmacies. They're getting the vaccines, no connection to a physician. They're getting them at tents and in parking lots. So I would think the reporting. But anyway, even if we accepted zero, a 1-to-1, 30,000 is unbelievably high. So again, I'm puzzled. Even if you take the most extreme conservatism as to how to count the numbers, we've never seen anything like this. We've never tolerated anything like this before.
Well, that's because it's been sold to the American public as something for everybody that everybody should do, as opposed to a targeted high-risk group who would be the ones who would actually.
Well, yeah, but the question is, but why would they ignore it now? Why would they allow that? Doesn't stop this money to take it off the market. Why would you want something like this on the market? Is my question
Well,
of
there are
you.
plenty of medications, cancer medications that are high-risk medications, that you have to balance the alternatives, regardless of how you
But
treat
this
someone.
medication, this one, Harvey, why? And I'm not going to push you anymore. It's unfair.
Well, no, I think that there are people at high enough risk of getting COVID who have high enough mortality risks for whom having a high mortality risk out of COVID is balanced against having a high mortality risk out of vaccination. I mean, as draconian as that is, those are the choices
Who
that
would that be? I mean, I'm 86. I would never take that vaccine because I'm so susceptible to the age factor on dying from the vaccine.
Well, I don't think age is necessary. Age correlates highly with comorbidities, chronic conditions. That, if you have diabetes, if you have
No,
cardiovascular disease,
but
chronic.
again, it puzzles me. It puzzles me that. But we can let it go. I think we've covered it. Let's give you a final word on why you think it's okay to have the vaccines on the market.
So, like I said, I think that the vaccines should have limited application and not widespread application. I think it was an utter mistake to have been a widespread across the board, plan, especially as I said, in children, in normal healthy children who don't need it. We can discuss again children with comorbidities. That's again a discussion. But by and large, most people in the general population have not needed this, and the vaccines have not contributed to reducing the spread of the infection, which was the only government and corporate interest. Whether it reduces severe disease, hospitalization, or mortality, it's a personal treatment decision. We don't force people to take treatments to prevent them from smoking, even though we know that smoking increases their mortality risk substantially. And yet and 500,000 people die every year from smoking-related diseases, which is way more than have died from COVID over the last 2 years. And yet we don't force behaviors on them, So we know what the real level of a pandemic is, and 500,000 deaths per year does not rise to the level of an emergency pandemic because we tolerate that in our society routinely.
What about with children? Do you think that that is also a choice? Would you say 12 and under or 15 and under?
I'd say that most children do not need it, that if a child has some serious chronic conditions, that that needs to be worked out with the physician who's sensitive and engaged on the pros and cons of the vaccine versus those conditions. And that's how, that's rational medicine. You know, I mean, we've always been doing it this way. We've never done, any, you know, one size fits all across the board for anything. And now is the same thing.
Well, I disagree a little bit. I mean, we take things off the market when they're killing too many people. I think this vaccine, under anything other than the enormous political financial pressures, under any other circumstance in this world, would have been taken off the market within a few days.
Well, let me just say that there is one other consideration, which is that FDA withdraws about 300 medications a year that it's previously approved. Of course, it approves about 10,000 medications a year, so 300 is a small fraction, but 300 medications a year is a large absolute number of things that are withdrawn because they performed poorly and had too great a risk. Now, those aren't in the level of pandemic. A vaccine that causes deaths, if somebody put out a pertussis vaccine that caused deaths, we would remove it from the market because we're not claiming that we're in the middle of a dire pandemic of pertussis so that everybody's going to die, you know, or is being pandered to fear that they're going to die. And so we have to do something about it. And therefore, we're willing to tolerate greater hazard in order to cope with a pandemic. That's how this pandemic was marketed to the United States and to the world, that the mortality predictions from modelers in UK and elsewhere were so dire that everybody feared was up, and we made wrong decisions based on wrong perceptions of the nature of the pandemic. And that's the problem here. So the vaccine should never have been across the board, that they should have been evaluated more carefully, that we can argue the pros and cons of keeping them in the marketplace or not. And I'm happy, you know, to do that. And maybe we could do that offline because we'll go on for hours. But the point is that this is a rational discussion about evidence, and that's how it should be done.
Well, I certainly agree with you about being rational about the evidence. I think we can let go of this for now, certainly. Tell me about where you're going with your own work right now. What did you see yourself doing? Where are you going with your work in general? Are you going to be spending a lot of time on COVID still?
Well, you know, to the degree that I have something to contribute scientifically on COVID, I'll continue working on that. I'd like to get back to my cancer studies, which have kind of been in abeyance for a couple of years. Mm. But COVID, you know, has demanded its own attention, I guess, and so that's how we've all got into this. I think that, as I said, as we discussed, that COVID has passed a large period of scientific knowledge, that we've gained a large amount of scientific knowledge, regardless of how much pushback from agencies, from media, from whatever, that the scientific studies are out there, and anybody's free to read the studies and draw one's own conclusions about them. And so we know a lot about effectiveness or ineffectiveness of all these various things. And that those, you know, we don't need more studies of ivermectin or more studies of hydroxychloroquine or more studies of masking or whatever. There's enough evidence to draw conclusions from that. So the science has landed very well to the point that you can get access to the objective science. Now we have to know what to do with it and how to manage it. And so we're in a period where the government is still claiming that we have an emergency, even though we have a variant strain of Omicron of the virus that is medically mild. So when doctors say something is mild, it means people don't go to the hospital. It could still be very uncomfortable, make you miserable for a few days. That's still considered mild, you know, medically. And so that's the nature of the illness now, by and large, for most people who get Omicron. And or maybe it's almost nothing. Some people just have sniffles and mild cold. So it runs a range of mostly mild disease. That does not rise to the level of an emergency. Furthermore, as I said before, that we tolerate 500,000 deaths per year from smoking-related diseases, and we don't call that an emergency. And we've never called that an emergency, and that's been, for my lifetime, has been like that. You know, so that's the grounds for it not being an emergency from COVID now. And so to the degree that our rights have been limited because of claims that we're in an emergency and the government needs to limit our rights in order to protect us from the pandemic, that claim is unsubstantiated, that we are not now in an emergency, and therefore it's time for the government to recognize that if we're some dire variant were to occur, you know, 9 months from now or something that needed the ability to marshal resources for the government to cope with it and declare that an emergency, then go do it then. But for now, we're not in an emergency. That the second Omicron wave that we've seen in the United States, which has been a very small kind of a bump wave, is now going down. It's likely to stay down for the rest of the summer. That if we get a wave in the fall, it's going to be derived most likely from Omicron, which means it will be likely very similarly mild in most respects for most people. And so we're not in emergency territory. And so for governments to say, to maintain emergency status, to renew these emergency declarations every month, every 3 months or whatever, constitutes abuse of the civil rights, of the human rights of the population. And that puts us into the era of litigation. So we finished the era of science, and now we're in the era of litigation. Huge. That Americans are very, very gracious, by and large, in giving up some of our rights for the good of the country, the good of the population, the good of other people. And we've done that. We've done that dramatically throughout this pandemic. But on the other hand, we're not going to give carte blanche to that process when there's no clear need for it. And so the balance of rights versus pandemic management is a trade-off. It's a balance, and we give more when there's strong evidence to support the necessity of limiting those rights in order to accomplish the public health measures that need to be taken. But when the public health issues are magnified and exaggerated in order to lay claim to limit more rights, when those are exaggerations, that constitutes abuse of rights. And that's the era that we're in now. And I've argued this in
it makes sense to me.
Journal and elsewhere, that with the emergency is gone. The emergency has been gone since the end of January. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean the pandemic has gone away, but it means the emergency has gone away. And we need to recognize this, and we need to recognize this in both public health administrations and government. And, Justices Alito Thomas and that was one other, said in one of the cases that they heard, I think last year, that once a government takes rights on the basis of pandemic management, it is very difficult to give them back, and constitutes the most severe form of abuse of people's rights. And I think that's what we're in now, and we have to face it, and we have to deal with it.
Yeah, well said, well said. Let me ask you about your own research a bit, because it's so relevant to some of this. You've done a lot of cancer research. Have you done work with the RNA and the DNA platforms and for cancer? And can you tell us about that? Has it been successful?
That's not really my areas of expertise. I've been a cancer epidemiologist, which means basically that I'm an empiricist, and I love lab work. I love animal work. That motivates me of what to study in humans. Mm-hmm. But for me, the definitive results are what you see in case control and cohort and randomized trials and unrandomized but controlled trials and so on. The epidemiology studies in people is what provides definitive evidence.
Right.
And you know, so you were talking before about studies in animals, and you know, there's a literature of studies in animals that don't pan out in humans. There are carcinogens in animals that are not carcinogens in humans, and vice versa. So again, you have to verify everything in humans, which is a problem, because you go into using something with incomplete knowledge. And the first humans to try, you know, in a trial, in a marketing trial and so on, are basically guinea pigs with kind of an educated guesswork, but still guesswork as to what response and what hazards they face.
Well, it's interesting. Again, we have a different slant. And I'm actually not in agreement with you. The early phase trials that are done on both humans and children for the FDA, I believe when you start getting a lot of deaths with animals, they would not give the same thing to a human with mammals. So if you have something that is poisonous to mammals, we're mammals. I think it would be very hazardous for anybody to go ahead and say, but we can try it on humans. You'd have to, I think, have an awfully good reasoning behind it. I personally took the mammal studies quite definitively in terms of the vaccines were acting exactly as they did in humans later on, and the mechanisms are all the same as in humans. So it's not like we're looking at mechanisms that humans have or animals have. So I would differ with you about, I think that was a little too broad. Maybe you think so too.
Well, I think this is a subjective judgment. And one of the other problems that we've had with viewing public health and what I call the one size fits all problem is that public health is an engineering discipline, that if you build a bridge and it keeps, you know, 1,000 cars go over it and only one falls off into the lake, then is that a success or not? You know, or 10,000 cars go over it and one falls into the lake, is that a success or not? So the question is, what adverse events are you willing to tolerate for the good of the people who benefit from it? And this is
I got to interrupt. That's an engineering problem, but I don't see public health as even remotely close to being an engineering.
It takes exactly that discipline of risk and benefit.
But the factors involved are the tens of millions of variables.
That's right. Ramp it up.
It's so different.
That is the reason why public health has tolerated tens of thousands of deaths from the vaccines, because it's claimed to have provided millions, hundreds of millions of benefit. And that is the equation, and it's the same equation of the bridge, that it's tone deaf to the suffering of those 20 or 30,000 people and their families. That's the problem.
I want to add quickly, too, that if they, you know, that this whole thing was predicated on the EUA, and the EUA required that there were no I didn't mention this earlier, that there were no effective treatments. So if there were effective treatments, they couldn't have done the whole vaccine thing. And so there's a tie in there. It doesn't get mentioned a lot, and I'm not sure why, but just want to remind people that not only did they want to use to get rid of hydroxy because it would help people, keep them out of the hospital, keep them from dying, and prevent the vaccine rush, which was this whole thing was built around, was the vaccines. But under the laws of the EUA, they couldn't do it, a whole emergency process, if there was even one good, effective, FDA-approved treatment. Didn't have to be approved for the specific disease. Best to fit that in. It's been really interesting having you on. Do you want to make a closing remark? You got about 40 seconds.
Well, I would just say that if the FDA actually held to its principles, that would have been true. But the FDA has approved multiple vaccines, you know, in spite of the fact that the other ones couldn't exist and allow a new one to come on the market. But they've done it anyway. So it's really hard to know what...
Well, that's right. They broke the rules, in other words.
Yeah. But that's... So we live in lawless times, unfortunately, that there's so much willful ignorance of laws that we are supposed to be having, and daring people to push back by litigation. And I think that's the climate we live in now, unfortunately.
Harvey Risch, thank you so, so much for being on this show with me. I deeply, deeply appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you.